Welcome, good people, to Book Circle Online. I'm Jason Squamata, and today we are going to be dissecting a strange and, I think, beautiful, though very dark, novel called Dead Stars by Bruce Wagner, who is semi-famous for his morbidly intellectual, savage satires of Hollywood culture. He has a film, he has written a film called Maps to the Stars that will be coming out soon, directed by David Cronenberg, starring Julianne Moore, Robert Pattinson, several other luminaries, and I believe it won the Palme d'Or at Cannes.
Did it really?
I think so. Or cool. Was at least, at the very least, in the running. It was shown at a theater near Cannes.
It was Italy, but it's very close.
Okay, right, yeah, no,
it was playing in the background of The Wrath of Khan.
Right, which did win the Palme.
I had a pun. Right. I had a pun. I was going to unload it.
I am here with my cohorts who are
Mark Savage,
Pat Janowski,
Christy Lovato.
And I, once again, am Jason Squamata. And please, step into the circle with us. Step into this strange tapestry of Hollywood sleaze, celebrity, cosmic ennui, cancer, desperation, feverish sex, porno.
And Betty White.
And Betty White, to boot. To booty bump, as
and
it were.
Betty White's booty.
And Betty White's booty. And sprawling, meth-fueled, deranged hip-hop conspiracy theories. A go-go. We're talking about Dead Stars. This is Book Circle Online. Step into the circle.
From the Library of Maria Menounos, this is Book Circle Online, featuring in-depth discussion, insight, news, and commentary on all the world's leading book titles and their authors. And now, Book Circle Online.
Okay, so we're back. Once again, I'm Jason Squamata. I'm here with my cohorts in the BCO team. And Dead Stars by Bruce Wagner. Let's get some thoughts. Mark, how'd you feel about it?
I'm still not exactly sure. I feel a bit unnerved, like I've spent a couple of weeks just cycling through the internet. Mm-hmm. This amazing device at my hands, and I'm not quite sure what to do with it. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
That's how I feel, it's tiring. My heart's kind of bumping a bit quicker, but that's the metaphor. The endless Facebook feed thing.
You
keep looking back, and it's like opening the fridge to see if someone's done the shopping for you, and there's nothing in there. It's just the same stuff you left there.
Uh-huh.
You keep looking. That made me think of this, and I don't know if it's a compliment to the author or if it's criticism.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Okay, Pat.
There you go.
Yeah.
This world is very familiar from, you know, BuzzFeed, from what's that guy's name that draws the pictures on the things? Paris Hilton.
Oh, Perez Hilton.
Perez Hilton.
Yes, yes.
God. That shows my neophytism.
You're a phony, Janowski.
Exposed!
I'm a phony. I'm not.
But really, who among us can tell the absolute difference between Perez Hilton and Paris Hilton?
Well, true enough. And to be a phony in, you know, your assessment of phonies makes you authentic by default.
Because two negatives make a positive.
Precisely.
If we're talking math. Yeah. If we're talking life, not so much.
Not so much.
Actually. And I have to say, the book was negative throughout. There were parts of it that I wanted more of. There were things that really, I got so tired of hearing over and over and over and over and over again, mm-hmm. which, you know, satire is difficult because when you're satirizing something, you have to show it. And if it's so distasteful, gosh, it's a really difficult thing to do. I admire Bruce Wagner for taking it on. I'm not sure whether he succeeded. That's what I'll say.
Okay. Fair enough. Christy, let her rip.
I probably could have lived my whole life without ever having read this book and been fine. I could have read a lot less of this book and been fine. I think what you referred to as sprawling kind of felt like wallowing to me at times, that there was so much. The first 120 pages, the introduction of all the characters, just the encyclopedic, endless star fucking, I'll call it, just the endless, like, referential kind of, and not to any point other than to categorically list, this is this character, these are this character's obsessions, this, here is this other character, here are their obsessions. It was tedious at times.
Okay. So, and when it got past that part of introduction, do you feel like, I mean, once things were actually happening to these characters and they were starting to interweave a little bit, did, I mean, were you caught up at all in the narrative drive of it, or did you feel like it was a wallow throughout?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't feel like there was a narrative drive, and forgive me for saying this, but I mean, I feel like while the characters sort of interwove, there was nothing moved forward. And the points where things were actually occurring, I mean, we'll get into it later, but the points where things were actually occurring between characters got skipped over frequently. Mm. Ricky's audition sequence and the, you know, the outcome of that, you know, was just sort of like, you're just being thrown, things are being thrown at you, and then you get this afterthought, like, you know, here's 2 weeks later, and here's 5 chapters about Ricky auditioning for this movie, and here's 2 weeks later, and he didn't get the part, and everyone's on drugs, and now they're doing porn. It's
right.
You know, it just didn't feel narrative to me at all.
Right. Well, that aspect of it, I mean, that to me felt like an authentic reflection of the disparity between, because I mean, in this book, all these different levels of Hollywood culture are, you know, are intersecting, like levels of it that are actually made up of celebrities and movies getting made, and then all these sort of bottom feeders and people slithering through the cracks of this Hollywood world. And it seemed like that felt real to me, that there would be this build up to Ricky's big chance. Ricky, this, you know, this messed up kid who has this dream of auditioning his way into this Michael Douglas, Lawrence Fishburne movie, and he's all about it for, you know, like the first half of the book, and he's looking forward to this moment. The moment comes, it's stolen from, it's like a blip in the life of the people who actually live in that world, and it's just, it's taken from him abruptly.
And that's, it's really sad.
Yeah.
Because his personal narrative of, oh, I lived this, this is my life, this is why I'm going to get this part, this is why I'm destined to get this part, doesn't come out because this other thing happens where Michael Douglas and Lawrence Fishburne walk in while
right.
he's doing the audition, and he forgets to mention that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's a tiny little thing, and it's effing tragic.
Yeah.
Or he forgot to mention it because he was so jacked up on prescription painkillers during the entire everything.
Well, yes, there's that as well.
Right. Okay. So the characters in this, the major characters, we have Ricky, who is a foster child. He's been in, his foster parents are these affluent, you know, sort of upper middle class
white folks,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And then there's his girlfriend, who's pregnant, Rihanna.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, formerly
slash Geraldine.
Geraldine, yeah. Yes, and whose mother Jackie made a semi-career for herself taking arty nude photographs of Geraldine later
as a child.
As a child.
Mm-hmm.
And her brother Jersey is the snatcherazzo, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Jeez, that whole concept was high layer.
Uh-huh, right.
To me.
Yeah.
Photoshopping in the tampon string.
Right.
In order to show that whoever it was, Hailee Steinfeld, or maybe it was even someone younger than that. Ah!
Right.
She's a woman now. She's, you know,
right.
Just for the pleasure of his boss, because they're not legally allowed to publish them till they're 18. Is
right.
that the...
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, so he's essentially collecting child pornography for his boss.
To jack off to.
Right.
who talks about it in this... he elevates it to this almost religious thing, the search for the crotch shot of
right.
the young starlet, or that prepubescent starlet. That,
yeah.
The long section on that.
Which long section?
Right.
But true. Well, this is another thing. The long sections. This is a really long book. Mm. I'm always saying this. Books should be shorter. But I think he's going for something with the length of this, and it's repetition. Sometimes the repetition is very repetitious.
Right. Right. And yeah. It's intentional, obviously, on Bruce Wagner's part, but does it work?
Does it work? Yeah, there are times when they're dwelling on events that we've already seen from another character's point of view, mm-hmm. and we're not necessarily getting anything that's that different, where it stumbled to me. Huh. But there are points where it just kind of veers off into the obsessive territories, and every character does this at some point, where they kind of take a thought and run with it, where... it goes down these rabbit holes that are incredible and weird, and they're some of the best parts.
Well, I feel like, I mean, usually when that's happening, it's one of the characters who is completely addled, you know, by some substance.
Yeah.
And so
mm-hmm.
Jersey's sort of, you know, methed out conspiracy theories.
He's most commonly the one.
Meth and something. They keep mentioning
Roxy's.
All those things.
Meth
Roxy's.
And Roxy's and heroin.
Do we know what Roxy's are?
Christy?
Why are you looking at me?
Sorry, I think I peeked out laughing there.
That's okay.
Do you know what Roxy's are?
No, I don't.
Okay. We can Google it. Well, it's such a morass of like different substances.
That's a good point because it's a book where you could sit there with a laptop open to Google.
What's true and what's not.
Right. You could Google, we're talking about references, we're talking about, there are so many puns based around.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much, there's a love of language here that's really incredible.
Well, and
that kind of, that need to make a pun from everything. And we hear it with every character's voice, which sometimes is interesting. Like, does Michael Douglas pun in the same way as a 15-year-old girl puns? But there's something about that that's really interesting to me. Because I think my brain works in a way like that. I think a lot of us do that, where someone will say something, we'll say the next thing because it sounds like a lyric from a song, and we need to sing the next line. It's written like that, with this kind of, this earworm kind of quality, where it's just...
Well, and it feels to me like everyone is annexing their whole, this whole universe they're in, into their own kind of jargon, you know? So that, like, Thelma, who is... at least at the beginning of the book, the youngest ever breast cancer survivor
diagnosed at the age of
her viver, which is a good example of the pun.
And who's had a double mastectomy, and she's 12 years old, and who is very quickly displaced by a little Canadian 4-year-old
who was diagnosed at the age of 3.
Yeah, and Thelma gets very upset about this, showbiz being what it is, and she annexes her experience, breaks everything down into, you know, this jargon of
cancer
kids. Everything starts with a K.
Right. And Jersey, to me, that like the kind of the meth language, the way that, I mean, everyone else is punnings in a very specific way that seems germane to their world and their agenda, but his compulsive, like, you know, I mean, the language is just corrosive and eating itself in those passages.
Right. And I have to say, I didn't hate the book. I felt like the redundancies for me did not work.
Christy Lovato, it should be a blurb on the back of Bruce Wagner's book, Dead Stars. I didn't hate the book.
Didn't hate it.
Christy
didn't hate
Lovato. It.
What? No, but
with an H and an 8.
For me, if you remove the redundancies, because they did not work for me, you have this series of really beautiful, heartbreaking vignettes of these people. Some of them are very uncomfortable. Ricky's introduction is
the most. I almost put it down.
It's very painful commentary on child pornography and the line between, like, that, you know, the more extreme forms of pornography that everyone has access to, and the complete disregard for whether it's real or not, and the rabid consumption of pornography that has a complete disregard for who, you know, he's obsessed with these, like, fake rape videos and is ruminating
fake,
over
maybe fake,
fake,
maybe not.
Fake, maybe not, doesn't matter, and it doesn't matter to him, and that's just that.
Well, I think he there's points where that's a problem for him. He's doing this very teenage thing of it's not a problem, and then occasionally he thinks, huh. And
well, then he's goes it's really past weird because he's a super sweet kid. You know, in Toto, sure, he commits all these whatever, but he's a really sweet guy. And this pornography chapter, it was just,
You're talking about the chapter near the beginning when he's looking at pornography.
Yeah, he's watching this, like, it's a fake rape video of a schoolgirl and her pediatrician and waiting for her to do the flip. He's talking about the switch where, you know, they resist, and then get into it. And he's waiting for that moment, and it's not coming, and it's not coming.
And he's like, is this real? Yeah. Is she just resisting because this is a person? And yet he keeps going, which is an impulse we all have. I mean, seriously, all of these characters have things that we all, they're all sides of us. We all contain multitudes, right? Mm-hmm. But his tenderness about his prospective adoptive family and all this stuff, it's in that chapter. God, it was really hard for me to finish.
Well, you know, but I think, I mean, all of these characters, with the possible exception of Tom Tom, who seems pretty consistently reptilian and just, you know.
Except I was totally captivated by Tom.
Oh, she was fascinating, yes. But
I was sad that she didn't go anywhere. I kind of wanted her to be like this, you know, lantern in the wilderness person.
Right. Yeah.
And not in a good way necessarily, just to go somewhere.
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, but
anyway, so go on.
All these characters, and I mean, and she, you know, she's like sympathetic enough that we would want that for her. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, all these characters sort of have moments of sweetness in their different ways. But they're all basted in apocalypse. I mean, this is an end of the world book.
Right.
I mean, this just feels like the most devastated, blown out, hopeless, empty world.
As far as you can take it. Yeah.
And like the only characters who can kind of, you know, just after they go through their stuff, they just kind of power on through. It's because their careers have advanced or they have enough money where they're not actually, they're not going to like fall backwards into some, you know, into the clammy shark tank of the world that they live in.
Right. The light, the shining light of this book is Michael Douglas.
Yeah.
Chaotic quest
to remake all that jazz with himself.
I love
Bob Fosse.
I love that.
I love that too.
Because the insight that when we hear this in Michael Douglas's voice, that he wants to be a genius like Bob Fosse. He wants to be this maverick, and he knows that he's not this maverick. He knows that in a career, he's had a career where people love him. People might not love him, but no one thinks he's genius. Everyone thinks he's solid.
Right. Mm-hmm. He wants to be an artist.
And yet, and he's kind of okay with that, but he's kind of not as well.
Yeah.
And how at his level, the worries he's having as a 70-year-old Academy Award winning successful man are fundamentally the same as the 15-year-old girl who wants to be a Kardashian.
Right. Yeah.
They're filled with the same insecurities.
Yes. Yeah. Everyone is insecure. Everyone is dissatisfied. And like what they're actually groping for, you know, with great futility is, you know, varies depending on where they are in the food chain.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the thing with the porn and the Ricky goes, in retrospect, I love how that foreshadows our last moment with him where after Rihanna, spoiler alert, Rihanna, his confused, but very sweet and just sort of, you know,
she's painfully stupid.
Painfully stupid.
She's actually the only super stupid person in the book.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And she gives birth to a child and dies in childbirth. And Ricky, realizes in the midst of one of his, drug frenzies that she went out to for a porno casting couch video, and he's watching it, and is tormented and sad, but just can't help jerking off to it. Yeah,
which is a real myth that sums up the whole book. There are moments that sum up, and that's one that some that kind of
I would have to agree with you, Mark.
That desolate, dirty, lonely, sad feeling that is also this kind of like. Quite like compulsive masturbation that's not even born of it's not even excitement, it's just kind of dutiful in its way. So Christy, you talked about redundancies. If the book could lose them, which parts would you lose, if that is a question you can answer?
I felt like we could have gone without two or three of the whole Puppet Mather.
Jersey's conspiracy theories.
You liked that.
A short history.
Yeah, I could do with a little novella of that. But I also think the accumulation, it gets to the point where it's losing something.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, I think
There's the first sort of breakdown. There's the sort of secretive revelatory speech to Jackie that he makes in the parking lot. She just wants it to stop.
I know. You should go. And then he goes on for another three pages.
Right. I mean, it served to move the story forward a bit. What was his nickname for Harry around the middle?
He had 100 nicknames.
He had 100 nicknames for Harry around the middle.
Some of his, like, his panty raving. That excessive. I mean, I felt like the parts that were the obsessive ramblings.
Yeah.
Which is, again, I think an artistic choice. Mm-hmm. And I'm just not sure whether it really worked. It was irritating. It was irritating to read. Something, Mark, that you had mentioned to me when you were reading this book a week or so ago. We were all talking about, they all have their own punny language. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, wow, it's kind of like we don't have separate voices.
Mm-hmm. Right.
While each of them has their lexicon, and Jersey is obsessed with the honey shot and Harry around the middle and the puppet Mathers. And Tom is, we don't get enough of her, but, you know, everyone's got their own things, but they're all kind of this clever, quick talking pun people.
Yeah.
Even Geraldine / Rihanna / not so many bulbs.
That was
in the
one
chandelier.
Of the early tediosities for me.
And you were saying, is there enough differentiation between the voices?
Right. Well, yes. Well, to me, that indicated just, a community of people brain damaged by social media.
That they can't keep a thought, so they always have to be...
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, to me, the only person who wasn't doing that...
Biggie.
Biggie, yes, but...
Love Biggie.
But we get to Biggie through Bud Wiggins.
Yeah, we don't really get his voice, do we?
Not very much. There's a little tiny bit.
His obsession is his mother and the cave thing. But he's without the capacity to.
Right. Well, we never get his interior dialogue.
Right.
I think you're right.
And and Bud Wiggins is Bruce Wagner, and Bud Wiggins has appeared in every Bruce Wagner book.
What?
Okay. Yeah.
I didn't know this.
Oh yeah. So.
Oh.
Right. So and the thing is, I'm a big fan of Bruce Wagner, and I've read all his previous books. Mm-hmm. None of his other books are like this. They're all about Hollywood and celebrity culture.
And they're not like this.
Well, they don't have this wordplay thing. I mean, the language is rich and vibrant and alive, but there isn't the specific effect that we're talking about.
Okay.
So, this is clearly like his...
Intentional.
Yes, this is his intention for this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But all of them are, you know, have... I mean, wildly different stories and different types of characters, but similar subject matter in the sense that it's looking at it's a kind of like Dzogchen Buddhist desolate view of human consciousness in Hollywood.
Right, but I felt like I was looking at the comment section without being able to help myself of every shitty news article that I accidentally clicked on at times while reading this. It's like. Geraldine is like the TMZ comment feed.
Right. Well, no, yeah.
There are comments in the book, aren't there? There are sections like that where there are.
Yeah.
But I felt like that part of the point of the book is that the article is gone. The news is gone.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. You never get the original.
And the news is frequently irrelevant. I mean, the news is frequently.
No, it's just another. It's like a starting point for the same people to have the same arguments about.
Yeah,
right.
Conspiracy.
Thelma's story is case in point. It's like you don't really get her. You get references to her suffering, to what she went through, to her mother being there for her when she was going through treatment, blah blah blah. But it's all about what's coming next, and it's like I've got to be this person. It's not the original. It's the comments section. That's a really good observation.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, I think part of what, and this is my sort of penchant for. I appreciate novels that get where they're going. You know?
Oh, spit it out, Christy.
There's no denouement here.
There's no
All
there,
of these
there.
People are. Yeah. They have a goal. They have an objective. They're sometimes being moved toward that objective. No one gets where they're going. Like no one.
Except Jackie.
Jackie a little comes full circle. Ricky kind of gets there by the end. He's banging Lawrence Fishburne's daughter, but then vomits all over her.
But all of their objectives, all their proposed destinations, are like narcissistic, vapid, and like ultimately extrinsic to their characters.
Yes.
Like where Rihanna gets where she's going.
Well, she gets dead.
Right. Like all these characters, everything that they do is an evasion of death. Like all these characters are pretending they're not going to die.
God, Jersey?
Yeah.
I'm so worried about him.
No, I'm not. I really hope he gets there.
Well, no, here's the thing. He becomes so detestable.
Right.
And he wasn't at the beginning. He kind of was. It's like he was a victim of that whole thing with his mom and the deal. But he just feeds it. And he grows himself into this monster by the end. But it was just, it was horrible to watch.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway,
so Jackie's interesting because Jackie has... at the beginning has artistic ambitions which have been somewhat thwarted. Her career maybe 10 or 15 years ago looked to be on the up. Now it's not.
Right.
And she seems to come to the point where with her daughter's death, she comes to the point where she doesn't want a career anymore.
Right. And that's when things start happening.
And then
for
things
her.
Start to happen.
Right. Yeah.
And she seems to be on the train again as if you know, what's the revelation? Is the revelation that the career is just something she doesn't need, or is that just a false realization? And then as soon as Steve Martin phones her, she's ready for it again.
Well, because she intentionally evades it until he phones her. She says no to the woman.
And then
but
she's not just proposing that she goes to the dinner that he wants. Like, she said, "Yeah, I'll bring some photos. I'll bring these ones.
This is it, but I want my own exhibition."
And I find that very human as well. That you know, you tell yourself, "My career's not working," so you tell yourself, "I didn't want a career anyway."
Right.
And then there's a possibility that the career you dreamed of could happen,
right,
and you jump on it.
Right.
And that was so sad. I mean, because
she jumped on it, but she manipulated that.
She manipulated that.
Yeah, but do you not sympathize with all of that process she's gone through? I mean,
initially she's trying to capture she's capturing these like devastated, broken down, like, you know, these dying towns, and she's capturing her own life, and she's, you know, she gets the speech. Who is it that gives her the speech?
Helmet Newton.
Helmet Newton.
Yes, her mentor, Helmet Newton. Yes.
Yes. That she needs controversy, and he goes, he has his own little rhapsodic sort of speech about...
It's not about the work, it's about the publicity.
Right. And about vagina.
He has a speech about vaginas.
Yeah. But, you know, and then her work turns into that, and she's trying to capture, she's trying to capture that controversy, and keeps falling short of it.
Well, because, you know, it's sort of disingenuous. I mean, like, like she falls ass backwards into the kind of, like, shock field of the work that she's doing.
And she doesn't capitalize on it as brilliantly as he wants.
Well, and it's the first time that she feels, and when, you know, the pictures of dead children thing, it's the first time that she feels like her work has any meaning, and she develops integrity about it and is protective of it until Steve Martin comes.
I think she's waiting. I think she's like a spider, and she's sitting there waiting for the big fish, to mix metaphors, to come along and land in her net. Wow.
It's a big spider.
Slash web.
Right.
Because she's, as far as we hear in her internal monologue, she's like, no. Actually, it wasn't internal. We only hear the conversation she has with the, like, broker woman, the woman in San Francisco whose photograph she took or something. And she's like, nope, absolutely not. Nope, absolutely not.
Right.
Nope, absolutely not. So when Steve Martin calls...
The celebrity who snubbed her.
To me, it's disingenuous. She has been waiting. Huh. And this is not like, now it's my integrity. For me, it's like, I've landed the big fish, so now I'm going
to
let it go.
I'm so much more sympathetic to her than that.
I found
like, at what point when you've had 15 years of near failure, do you think that there are going to be all these big fishes coming along, you know?
Why does she wait? Why doesn't
because she... Because she actually, you can take her at her word, maybe, that she does. Maybe. She's not sure if this is going to work.
Well, right up until the point before the book starts, she is... she's just trying to make a life for her kids at this point. She's not working on her career. She's just trying to pay the bills. Mm-hmm. She's trying to take care of Rihanna. She's Geraldyn. She's, you know, she's taken a job at Sears in the portrait studio.
You know,
and, I find her story is one of the hardest ones because she has two children who, and she says this herself, she feels like she's failed as a mother. She has two children who have got themselves into different predicaments, and
they feel she's they feel failed as a
yeah,
mother.
And that's that. There's a horrible part in the middle of the book when she kind of fantasizes about this future where she's on cruises, she's giving blowjobs to old men who wear captain's hats on cruises and who make certain kind of jokes. That was one of the saddest parts of the book for me.
That's an ambition for you, Jason.
No, that's all I hope for.
I know. I'll buy you the captain hat.
That'd be awesome. Oh, I thought
No, I'm not going to.
I would be taking care of the
captain. I have two kids, but no. well, who knows, right?
You can wear the captain's hat this week.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. Now, I feel like, okay, Jackie is very sympathetic to me. I feel like she's trying.
Is it because we can understand her impulse as an artist in a way that we can't necessarily understand, say, Riona's impulse to want to be a Kardashian?
Right. Well, I get that too. That's just that's just who you are. Do we think that has less
wanted to be a Kardashian?
Me neither.
But do we think that has less integrity than wanting to be an artist?
But the thing is, have you been at a party with Kardashians?
No.
When you go to a party with
Kardashians, have you, Jason?
Yes.
Tell us, please. Tell us your experience.
I don't want to, but.
But I will.
But
reluctantly.
No, just two of them, the mom and Kendall.
Well, I don't even think it counts unless it's a full set.
Well,
Kendall even a Kardashian?
Yes. Well, she's a Jenner, but she counts. Anyway, like, the thing is, I'm telling you, and I know, you know, what, like, I know you have integrity. I know, you know,
whatever that means.
Whatever that means. Mm-hmm. But, like, I can guarantee there'll be one shining, ugly moment in the midst of that where you, like... You're like, I could do with more of this.
I'm the star fucker.
I think the book gets into some of that stuff.
Oh, very much so. And that's what I think is the ultimate turn with Jackie, that I believe in her integrity. I think, like, in the kind of tapestry, like the resounding note of desolation, again, the apocalypse speaks in when... Okay, I've come to this piece. I've gone through all this. I'm finally here with my work, and I believe in my work, and I don't want to sully it, and this is important, and it has nothing to do with my career. Oh, but Steve Martin?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Steve Martin called. Steve Martin is calling.
Who snubbed us.
But he's also from Mount Olympus, not Mount Olympus.
Right. And there's also this – I mean, I also think there's a hierarchy of credibility, whereas if a Kardashian had called her, she might have felt differently.
Yeah.
But Steve Martin is not only A-list, but he's longtime A-list, and he's completely inside the circle.
Well, and she's from a generation that is not so debased and basted in like the filth of a modern world that is schizophrenic and insane. Like, her children aspire to Kardashianhood. She aspires to genteel, quasi-intellectual Steve Martin.
But that's what's interesting to me.
I am a wild and crazy guy.
Yes.
Steve Martin, genteel.
But I'm also super smart
everybody,
and funky, I'm a painter.
I'm just pointing out the irony.
That's what's interesting. Listen to me. If you could rewrite this book and replace all of the contemporary references with classic Hollywood figures,
I agree.
Uh-huh. If Kim Kardashian was Lana Turner, we might think it was a different book. And I think a lot of people who I've told people I'm reading this, they say, "Well, what's it about?" And I'll say, and I'll tell them,
and they'll
turn their noses up.
Right. You'll say what?
And they'll think, "Oh, that sounds putrid and awful."
Yeah,
and. And he's going in there.
Right,
you know, it's not about, you know, it's not a Second World War romance. It's not about a, you know.
Yeah.
It's doing ugly things.
But, and that is almost more depressing. This is actually a commentary on our times. This is where we live. But, and what I wanted to say earlier about Jackie is that, and I think for me where the sympathy for Jackie comes in is that, that she has sort of resigned herself to being a mother and trying to make up for having failed as a mother. And her daughter is dead. I mean, at the point where she decides that she's going to kind of take the bait, she's got nothing else to be to have integrity for. Jersey is clearly
gone.
She has a granddaughter who she can't...
Because the adoptive parents are taking
the Yeah.
Took the grandchild.
Right. Took the grandchild, and she.
But that says everything, doesn't it? In the moment, that's when you need to be able to be the human being that you can be, and you can't necessarily. You can make your peace afterwards with the fact that you weren't. Uh-huh. That's easier than actually day-to-day being...
in the trenches.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, I struggle with this because, yes, I do sympathize with her need to be an artist, failing over years, wanting to maintain integrity, waiting and waiting, waiting, and then Steve Martin calls. However, as a reader, I saw that moment coming, the moment she photographed the dead baby mm-hmm. with the people in Arizona or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, this is the meaning of this book. She's going to succeed with these photos of dead babies. I did not foresee the death of her daughter uh-huh. and the fact that she was going to photograph her dead daughter with the live baby. That's right. A nice little twist.
Right.
But for me...
But still, you knew that was not going to turn out good.
For me, mm-hmm. no. For me, I knew that this is where she was going to make her career. That was going to be the triumph at the end of the book, was Jackie being known for these amazing pictures of dead babies or dead, as it turns out, dead people, dead stars.
Right.
And so it's my impression of her is also tainted with that. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just too much reading. Maybe that's too much cynicism.
To me, I mean, there was something, I mean, in the midst of all this bleakness and failure and self-destruction, that chapter where she is showing that first death picture that she took for the first time to her old friend and another cohort of Helmut Newtons and part of that art world, and he is spellbound and is just staring at it, and she like, and then she gets the call that like she has another gig, someone else wants a picture taken of their dead baby,
right?
Like that not only is an art person not humoring her but is actually rendered speechless by her work, but that wait, there's a market. Like, not just that there's a market that people will want to see these pictures, but I can keep this rolling. Like, I'm performing a service. I'm like, I'm helping people.
I absolutely saw that, but I couldn't separate it from the market.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I do.
But you can't.
Well,
I mean,
yes.
That's the truth, isn't it? You can't.
Yeah, well, even in the Michael Douglas chapters where...
I loved the Michael Douglas chapters.
Oh,
let's just say he's
amazing. And I feel like, I mean, the voice
I
just feels
love
so
him now
real.
After this book.
Yeah. And the banter between fictional Michael Douglas
and
fictional
Catherine
Yeah, wonderful. And yeah, and she keeps making kind of sort of dumb jokes. And
she's awesome.
Yeah, right.
But
yeah.
The Kimmel appearance is perfect.
Yes. Yes. And when in the he always kind of goes to this place at the end of a paragraph. Now, she's a sweet kid. That felt like such a Michael Douglas thing.
An old-fashioned.
Yeah.
And his generational difference.
Well, he's right, the old guard, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Well, his dad was the old guard. And all the references to his dad and what a dad he was.
Right. And how his stroke gave him peace and how, you know, And, the Michael Douglas stuff, he's on this sort of, you know, spiritual quest too. Mm-hmm. This all that
right.
jazz.
All that jazz.
Sort of
the obsession with Bob Fosse.
Yes.
The virile power of Bob Fosse.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and, but he, it's all jungled up with career. I mean, he's been this enormously successful person, mm-hmm. but is measuring himself against all these other people. I mean, everyone in this book is a rabid, insane careerist.
Well, no and doesn't he reaches at a point, uh-huh. a point, I'm sorry, when someone says to him, well, you have to make it, whether or not it's his therapist, that
old
woman who is super awesome.
Right, right.
That it becomes sort of detached from his career, that it's for him.
Right.
Right.
And well, whether it's a good idea or not.
Right, well, but I feel like these characters can't like imagine any kind of fulfillment or spiritual wholeness outside of the context of career fulfillment.
And
right.
success.
I mean, I mean, there's always some kind of, you know, even, I mean, Gwen, Thelma's mom, is in the cancer business. She's in the cancer survivor business.
That's why she's so devastated.
Rihanna imagines fulfillment having a three-way with Jay-Z and Kanye West. That's not career advancing.
Well,
what? It isn't?
Well,
no. Yes.
Shoot, I have to call somebody.
Can you Google that?
I'm not sure. Right. I have to make a call.
Yeah. Oh dear.
I think I made a big mistake.
Oh my goodness. Yes, Puppet Mathers, J-Hove, and Iovine. But
oh my god.
Yeah. So I mean,
you were going to say something. No, sorry.
Well, so to me, I mean, despite I will, you know, agree with the, you know, excesses and the, you know, whether intentional or not, of the wordplay and the, you know, deranged rambling of, you know, these drug-addled kind of hollow people. But the abiding beauty of this book, and I feel like Bruce Wagner's wheelhouse, this is kind of like what he does, is...
Thank God they still say wheelhouse.
Yes, right.
Sorry, well, Jason, uh-huh. Jason's Cuamata
yes.
says wheelhouse, which is why I hang out with him.
Okay, right? Me and Bud Wiggins, we still love that word.
That's right.
And Tolkien. But I feel like Tolkien was maybe just catering to poor Bud.
He was a great character.
But Bud Wiggins is amazing. And I mean, if after this you feel like reading any more Bruce Wagner
I do
books,
now. Actually, well, not... Because of what you said, that he's Bud Wiggins, I'm like, okay, that I'm interested in.
Well, he was in Bruce Wagner's first book was Force Majeure, which is about Bud Wiggins living with his mom. He's a 35-year-old struggling screenwriter.
Let me just interrupt to say that relationship was hilarious.
Fantastic, right?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
When he goes into the hospital and she's like, swanning around.
Right, yes.
Oh, shit, this is the end.
Yeah. Well, but I love that, you know, while most authors, when they put themselves in their work, you know, they'll give themselves some good-natured jabs, but they tend to hyperbolize themselves and turn themselves into superheroes. But Bruce Wagner... I mean, he's made, you know, like movies with Oliver Stone, with David Cronenberg. He, like, knows a lot of these people that he's talking about. He's part of that world. But his analog in these books is a failure, is a cloying failure who is always, like, falling. And he
one step behind.
Yeah. And
at least.
Right. And who doesn't work that hard and, you know, is constantly beating himself up. And, And that's kind of beautiful.
And he's a 60-year-old wannabe.
He's a 60-year-old wannabe. Yes. Bruce Wagner.
Okay, so the fact that I didn't, like, you know, key into that with B, Bud, Wiggins, Bruce Wagner, BW, and there's a U in his first name and the G in the last name.
Right.
I'm an idiot.
Not at all. Not at all.
I'm kind
well,
of
maybe,
an idiot.
But not for that.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, sweetheart.
Oh,
you're welcome.
Oh, that's so sweet.
She's so kind to me.
Oh, but about the wheelhouse, like, yeah, I mean, just like looking at this world where every kind of fulfillment is jungled up with economic concerns or mm-hmm. even like beyond the economics, just this vague idea of career. This vague idea of success. Mm-hmm. And in this world where there's this very specific meaning to success, here you wear this watch, you have this car, you live in this neighborhood. And to stare coldly at a whole culture of striving people, and a culture like this community is defining the fashions, tastes, no matter how much we dismiss their crassness, for the mass of people globally, their dream lives, who people masturbate to or whatever faces they project on their lovers. Like,
or what the body image of the current woman is.
Yeah.
That is one thing I am grateful to the Kardashians for, and I hope it continues, is that regularly shaped women will be like, that's kick-ass. That's awesome. Like, I have the ass of a teenage boy. It's kind of flat. I really want a little more back in the back area, in the trunk.
Uh-huh.
And so I envy the Kardashians that. Right.
But you're regular as well.
Well, yeah, but and you realize there's a whole, there's a world of men who long for nothing but the rack of a lovely
Kardashian.
Woman.
Yeah.
And combined
well,
with the
and
hind
that
quarters
alone,
of a teenage boy.
But do the Kardashians then not fit the type? They're not.
I don't know. They're not the model of today.
Okay.
And I like that. And I'm just, I don't know.
It's great, but isn't there something inherently pernicious and disturbing about the fact that we're thanking the Kardashians?
Yes. And the fact that body
for
type
not being
for adjusting our cultural
is even
body
an issue. Yes, yes, and yes.
Yes. And yes. And I feel like that ambiguity, the fact that we feel like we do want to thank people for setting a certain standard, for
breaking the standard.
Yeah, or for tweaking social programming this way or that way. Like, we feel gratitude towards the lofty gods, you know, for wearing something that we might be able to afford, because then...
One of the most radical things you could do would be to go to the Oscars and not wear something expensive.
Right.
That would get you an incredible amount of
praise. Who are you wearing tonight? The Gap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Someone wore a dress from Kmart. I can't remember who it was. It was probably about 12 years ago.
Chloe Sevigny.
Was it?
She would. I like
someone
her.
Did, and I can't remember who, but it was a utter coup. It was yeah.
The people can't stand it.
They can't take it.
Drives people crazy.
But that's the other thing. I mean, we talk about this world, this kind of L.A. centric, ambitious world. You can expand that to everybody.
Yeah.
That kind of the yearning that people are doing in this book, the desperate searching, is something that I think we all do in some way.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And it in a way where we're thinking about our careers, the things that we want to be doing,
right.
Things. Well, this isn't what I want to do, but will it help me do this?
Right. Well, and that there is something in the human animal. I mean, we have God buttons in our brains,
mm-hmm.
and these people who have achieved something that we personally define as success, whoever they may be, and we're seeing the L.A. world, but there are references to the Helmut Newton, world, to, the New York literary world, to Toni Morrison and Fran Lebowitz, and Michael Douglas, shedding a tear for Christopher Hitchens, because he... Yes, a fallen demigod. Yes, he too was part of our great circle. Oh, what a loss. And we are all diminished, us gods, by the loss of... And, the fact that... that we're looking at some lofty peak, and anyone who happens to be up there is kind of determining the language that we dream in, and that it ennobles us and maybe drives us to want to be like these figures if we find someone who seems to conform to our dream image of ourselves. But at the same time, we hand over power to them.
Right. And I think actually the happy ending in this book, if there is one, belongs to Thelma and Biggie. Because they have opted out of that dream.
Right.
Not Thelma, not necessarily by choice.
Uh-huh.
She doesn't know yet that she never had breast cancer.
Right.
But right? Oh Jesus,
the biggest tragedy beyond Rihanna's death.
I know, it's the great great twist.
Thelma never had
but
cancer.
She's also losing interest in that whole cancer survivor thing. She's like, whatever. And after she French kisses Britney on them.
That was like, funny.
Hilarious. So and Biggie admits, I only have two or three more in me, and they're changing his medication, so he's not so obsessive. He's losing his touch, and everybody knows that. But they've found each other.
Right.
And they like each other just because they do.
Yeah.
And they recognize, or she recognizes his weirdness or whatever, and it's just kind of out of the game.
Right. Right.
But
he has that luxury because he lives in a Willy Wonka cave that was built by his father who patented the idea of patenting ideas or whatever he did.
Right.
That's funny.
True enough. But I like that as much as, this book sort of deals with class issues or the disparities between these different rungs of the success ladder. The striving people are for the most part, amoral and deranged in their striving. It doesn't posit loftiness as a place of corruption necessarily. Michael Douglas, very sweet man, and maybe he has the luxury of being sweet because he was born into a movie star family and
then had cancer, so has the sympathy.
Yes, but also could afford to have specialists treat him and
all of it. Yeah.
Yes, but specialists were misdiagnosing him as well. And so, Biggie, he might, you might say that he has, the luxury to, change his life course or to change the aspirational direction of the next generation.
But he's internally so messed up.
He is, and I feel it felt like whenever we went to the Brainerd place that it was a fairy tale place. It reminded me of the F. Scott Fitzgerald story, The Diamond as Big as the Ritz.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, where, completely.
Where all the, the sort of the, symbolic web that Fitzgerald always uses with the shimmering richness but the sadness behind it is turned into flat out fable.
Right.
And in the idea that Bertrand Brainerd, Brando and Biggie Brainerd's dad, he came up with the idea for the three digits at the back of the credit card. And everyone has to pay him, every time a company uses one of those.
So
and
funny.
That he came up with, he patented the idea of patenting ideas. And I don't know if that's like even like possible in any legal schematic, but like the way that it could delicately, you know, that there's just this little pocket. As soon as you get to that fairy tale place, mm-hmm. everyone else, however deranged they are, whatever their conspiracy theories are, they're trapped in the physics of a universe we recognize. But mm-hmm. here's this fairy tale place
where they have their
own
physics.
And Vicky is like the inverse of Bud Wiggins, because like here's this, you know, his brother just wants to be a producer.
Right.
And he doesn't have any ideas.
Right. Yeah.
He doesn't like any of the things that people are pitching to him. He likes to pitch to people, and the things he pitches are the things that his deranged little brother just spits out on a whim.
Yeah.
And this kid is an idea machine.
Yeah.
That is never wrong.
Yeah.
Temporarily.
Temporarily, right. But even at the end there, what is his big – he's essentially by the end he wants to make a film about his mother dying.
Yeah. Or the cave thing. Or
the cave thing.
That she's traveling and –
and she's trapped or there's some sort of...
The Antigone story.
Yes.
Yeah.
Betty White.
Okay, well, that's... Okay, another thing. Mount Olympus. I loved, and, you know, this Mount Olympus metaphor has come up, but I love that this actual Betty White's house on Mount Olympus. Betty White, who is like the old, old, old guard, mm-hmm. you know, who's...
Now, had she... Excuse me while I chew. Had she made her resurgence by the time this book was written?
I think so. She just had it. It makes a reference to it.
It feels there were a couple of things which felt like they were just a bit out of date, but largely it felt really contemporary as a novel could possibly be.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That was daring to have so many cultural references.
Right.
And that might say something about me.
Yeah. No. I think he's pretty up to the minute. But I like that Mount Olympus, that all the, like, Michael Douglas and all these successful characters, Lawrence Fishburne, they're in this figurative Mount Olympus. And we have a real Mount Olympus that has been hijacked by these monsters. By these horrible monsters, filling it up with reality stars, daydream believers.
Right, like, because at the last minute, that Betty White's hairdresser's house sitter fell through.
Right.
Right, yeah.
And then Tom,
yeah,
T2, loved her. She was really intriguing to me. And I'm, like I said earlier on, I was disappointed that she didn't come to more.
Right. Yes, talk to me.
The reality TV show convention.
Yes. that this is the apocalypse. Like, where do you go from reality TV? I mean, you're seeing like the degradation of celebrity, of show business.
And Tom is our voice and our eyes in that, because she can't even get the third cast off from the 17th season of Big Brother, because it's like, call my agent.
But so, Big Brother is fairly A-list in reality TV. That's what's interesting. There's a pyramid of reality TV, and she's just descending it.
Yeah. Well, she is a disgraced American Idol contestant.
Right, because she faked some stressful life circumstance.
A paraplegic boyfriend.
Right.
It was actually just a girl she knows, paraplegic brother, that they took a picture for sympathy, because everyone was pulling the sympathy card that season.
Right.
Well, that's what's interesting is everybody kind of fakes their real story. But if you really fake your real story, then you're a disgrace. It's like you have to play the game.
Uh-huh. Right.
Everyone accepts the reality TV is false up to a point. But if you try and really go over that line, you're in trouble.
Can TMZ pick apart your story? That's
right.
Well, right. I mean, can we, you know, like that we want you to perform in a role that we've agreed on?
And then, the other side of that is if you do then falsify your story and people sympathize with you, then you still win. You still get to stay on the show. It's all about the court of the public opinion, isn't
it?
And people go through this cycle of...
Well, sometimes they find out that you falsified your story. Sometimes they do not.
But also, I mean, who can say the public opinion goes one way, then it goes the other way? You look at someone like Miley Cyrus, where she makes a public appearance, which she gets attacked for. And then there's the defense of Miley Cyrus. And this all happens in a 24-hour cycle where there's, which side of the feminist
side? Well, and this is rippling on the surface.
We can't attack Miley. We should attack Robin Thicke. No one's talking about this guy. And it goes in this cycle. whereby, and in such moments, that's when a career is made or broken. Well,
but at the same time, that's happening on the surface of actual Miley Cyrus units being moved, which can happen independently of however
being
that's
being a villain
going.
In the story is still being in the story.
Right, right. And if the units in the are moving story. And people are still talking about you, like how they feel about you is almost irrelevant.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And what's going to happen with Thelma when her story comes out? Is it like, oh, she took advantage of all this fake... Right.
Well, but like you said, I think her like she does have the closest thing to a happy ending with Biggie, and that she's moved into a zone where like no one can touch. They live in
mom.
Right. Yeah.
Well, anyway.
Yeah.
That's a good. Yeah. Right. I liked my observation there, Jason.
I liked it as well.
Thanks for referring back to it.
Well, and it's nice to have our attention drawn to a happy ending in this morass of desperation.
What do you guys think?
So there's this feeling like I had no sympathy for Tom. I will just come right out and
well, I imagined her
in opposition
as this,
to you
as this cute line cook at this place where I'm working as a host right now, and seriously, when they said Tom, I thought, oh, Danny, who's totally adorable, and she and I, for some reason, I don't know why I thought that.
Well, see, now you're like Cherokee, and that you know, like I know Tom's bad for me, but you know, there's just something about her. She's so cute.
What's Cherokee?
Cherokee is the hairdresser.
Yes, exactamente.
So, yeah. She just keeps butting up against this. If I put all the right pieces together,
right.
Then it's destiny, you know.
Gets a toehold. The first person she tries to get on her reality show is a detestable Z level reality X contestant, and then it only goes downhill from there.
The doctor from.
So I can't tell you why, but maybe.
And by the end, the only connection she's able to make are with porn industry people, and they end up shooting porn in Betty White's house.
In Betty White's house.
Starring Chippy D, a.k.a. Montana Fishburne, who – and I love the fact that – I mean, we're seeing Lawrence Fishburne cavorting with Michael Douglas on the lofty peaks of Olympus, the figurative Olympus, and that – but that, you know, like there's no way Ricky, outside of that one golden shot at the audition, that he would have a chance to be in the same room with someone like Lawrence Fishburne, but that these veins, these – addled syphilitic nerves like connect all these different, you know,
Larry
like
Fishburne's
levels.
Daughter on the other mountain.
Right, yeah. And it's a pageant of degradation and confusion. Do we have closing thoughts
pageant
on Dead Stars?
Of degradation and confusion.
And yes, but to me, you know, the thing is, I don't. As viciously satirical as a lot of the material in this book is, I don't satire in my mind usually is like a pure satire is something shallow because it has an agenda.
I didn't think of this as a satire at all.
No, it was looking like very coldly and like despite the horror, I felt with great compassion
because Bruce Wagner realizes to mock reality TV that's not going to make a novel.
Right.
Because that's what everybody does.
It's like mocking a child for not being tall.
Right, right. But to expose, right. But the internal dialogues of people
and to find yourself sympathizing with the paparazzi guy who was trying to take pictures of underage girls and understanding maybe the impulse.
No, not
in this...
pictures of underage girls, but pictures of the snatches of underage girls.
Yeah.
Yes.
Underage celebrities, which is the key part of that.
Right, right.
And to really try and understand that beyond just material gain, which is a huge part of that, understand somehow why someone would end up doing that.
Right, right. And to realize that everyone, like whatever choices they're making, they're spinning whole religions and spiritual quests out of whatever desperate
because that's what
thing
we do. It's easy to say, I'd never do that.
Uh-huh.
But he is like aspires to a show at the Gagosian.
He does. He aspires.
But just to fuck with his mother.
Credibility.
At the Gagosian. That part, again, as a theme, was hilarious.
Like he doesn't give a damn about the Gagosian except insofar as
I wanted him
it
to
would hurt
succeed.
His mother.
What's wrong with me?
Well, but then...
Well,
because
know.
You hate Jackie, just because you wanted Jackie to be hurt too, because you're suspicious of her.
No. I didn't want her. I wasn't suspicious. It's just I saw through her, and maybe it's because I'm just exactly like her. Oh. I don't I don't know why.
Jersey Sigma.
No, I sympathize with Jersey, and I wanted him to have that. Like this is what people are consuming as fine art. I kind of liked that idea.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
My you know, upshot on the whole thing is, yeah, great themes, great blah, blah, blah. But shoot, it was such a chore to read.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe all great works of fiction are like, but I don't know.
Well, did you try reading it out loud in the dark?
I read Anna Karenina and couldn't put it down.
Right. There's not enough pussy in Anna Karenina for my taste.
There's so much pussy. It's just between the lines.
Yeah, I don't want to have to work that hard. Yeah.
Oh, snap.
Chugga, 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 chugga. Woo, woo.
I just peeked out again. Sorry.
Dang, that's all right. I like when you do that.
I appreciate everything you guys are saying.
Yeah.
And it was just, it took me a long time to get through this book.
Yeah.
That's because it's so fucking big.
Right. Okay. Well,
this is valid.
Yes. No, a word to the wise out there. If you haven't read Dead Stars, you know, it's a challenging read. And, but I think its excesses are like experimental excesses. I mean, it's just occasionally in the midst of this immersive, empathetic, you know, like story, it takes this very intentional jag into experimental fiction. Okay,
I just want to say in closing,
postable things. Go ahead.
That Rihanna is a poster child for the dangers of being on the internet without critical thinking skills. That's all.
Good point. Okay, mm-hmm. Right on. A cautionary tale.
I think it was a cautionary
tale. Dead Stars, a cautionary tale.
A real big cautionary tale.
A huge, long cautionary tale.
The whole book
is
a cautionary tale of being on the internet without critical thinking and or being in Hollywood without critical thinking, which I think...
Or on the casting couch,
so to speak.
Right.
No, literally.
Right?
Or to strive. I think to have an idea of success and to strive for it without necessarily taking joy in the thing that you're doing to get there.
Losing your own, what you know in your core to be success, which is not usually what the world defines as success, and losing that in the, as you said, morass of all this crap that's being thrown at us at what it means to be successful.
Yes.
It's a cautionary tale about wanting stuff.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Ooh, Christy Lovato. That's the other quote on the back of Dead Stars. Fair. Besides, I didn't hate it. Is that what you said?
I didn't hate this book.
Didn't hate this book.
Right on. Mark?
If Jonathan Franzen mentions a cell phone message, a text in a novel, he's considered to be a great contemporary novelist. This is the great contemporary American novel.
Yeah.
What does that make Bruce Wagner?
Thank you so much, my dear, dear friends, for joining me in this exploration of filth and glitter.
Exploration,
if you will. This has been Book Circle Online. I'm so thankful for all of you listening in to our lovely little program. We're here by the good graces of Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro, the mistress and maestro of AfterBuzz TV. This is Book Circle Online. If you dig us, you can dig us on YouTube. You can dig us on the website, bookcircleonline.com. You can dig us on iTunes.
iTunes.
Dig us on iTunes. Tell your friends to dig us on iTunes. Leave comments. Leave stars. Like us. Hate us. Tell us what you want us to be. Maybe we'll be that. Engage us in a dialogue. We want to know you. Until that happens, or even in the midst of that happening, we urge you to be bookish, to be circular, to keep reading alive, and to remember us, your dear loving friends, who will be slithering through your dreams this evening and for every evening hereafter. I'm Squamata. This is
Christy Lovato.
This is
Pat Janowski.
This is
Mark Savage.
And we are Book Circle Online. Thank you very much and good night. May all your stars be dead stars.
From managing editor Jason Squamata, executive producers Maria Menounos, Phil Svitek, and Kevin Undergaro, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Book Circle Online. For more discussion, go to bookcircleonline.com. And if you have comments, questions, or book title suggestions, write us at info@bookcircleonline.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this is Book Circle Online. BCO, join the circle.